Talk a little bit about musky fishing now and about a book that's out there. It's actually two books in one, Volume 1 and Volume 2, A Compendium of Musky Angling History. And the author is with us by phone, Larry Ramsell of Hayward, Wisconsin, a musky fishing historian, the author of the two-volume set. It's now in its third edition, and we're having him on. The third edition is published by the House of Musky Publications and Infinity Publishing Company. And really pleased to have him on. This third edition is just out this year, so we're really pleased to have him with us today to talk about his books and talk about musky fishing. And also, we're really pleased to have Gary Engberg back. Gary from Mazamani, professional fisherman and guide. He's also an outdoors photographer, columnist, and co-host of a Madison-based radio show, Outdoors Horizons. I'm really pleased to have them both with us. Gary, thanks for being here with us in the studio. Appreciate it very much.
It's always a pleasure, Larry. Thank you very much.
And Larry Ramsell of Hayward with us by phone. Larry, hi. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me on, sir.
I really appreciate having you with us. The first edition of your book, by the way, came out in 1982, and it has forward to the in his forward to the first book, Ken Schultz of Field and Stream says, if the Smithsonian Institution had a branch for musky lore, you would be the executive director. That's a pretty cool statement.
Yeah, that's quite a compliment coming from somebody of that stature in the fishing world.
When were you bitten by musky mania?
Well, probably in the early 50s when my dad started becoming a musky fisherman and took me along and took the family along for a two-week vacation every year to the Hayward area here.
And you've been doing it ever since and actually become quite a historian. And your third volume, or your third edition of this is expanded into two volumes, so it has more and some different information than you had in your first editions.
Yes, it kind of took on a life of its own. I did a second edition in 1997, but between 1992 and present, there's just been a tremendous amount of controversy in the musky world regarding world records, and I had a lot of new information that had never been made public or published, and after the Hall Frames spray decision, I decided it was time to lay all the cards on the table and do an update.
And you did that. And, Gary, have you had a chance to look? You know, I have not finished these books. I can tell you that right now.
Neither have I. I mean, I could take the whole winter if I had nothing else to do and read them. Larry, it's nice to meet you.
You too, sir.
And we've got, and I think each book is like 600, somewhere around 600 pages long. So there is a lot of information on it. By the way, if you'd like to join in, let me give you the number. It's 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. And if you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. And Larry, if I'm not mistaken, records started, well, let's see. Was it Field and Stream that started the records?
Actually, they started a fishing contest, an annual contest, through their magazine in 1911. And as an offshoot of that, they started recognizing fish that were considered to be world records. Unfortunately, at that time, if you didn't enter your fish in the Field and Stream contest, whether it was bigger than the current world record at the time or not, it was not considered. So it was kind of a, you know, just a sideline for Field and Stream at the time, and it was being mainly done just to generate reader interest and new readership.
Larry, what was your criteria initially for someone submitting a world record?
Would you repeat that, please?
What was the criteria that Field and Stream used?
A fish had to be weighed on a certified scale. They varied the way they took length measurements over the years from total length to fork length, and at one point in time they required both measurements, but today it's total length and then a girth measurement. But certified scale has always been a criteria of their contest since its inception in 1911.
And how many witnesses or did they have to have? Or
The forms that I've seen back through the years always required two witnesses to the catch. Not actually to the catch, but to the weighing of the catch.
There were a lot of interesting characters. I want to get Dave and Cumberland on first here, and just to get a caller in here, and then we want to talk some more about some of the characters associated with musky fishing. But again, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890 with your musky question, be it fishing or history. And Dave in Cumberland, you're up. Hi, Dave.
Good morning.
Morning.
I suggested this to you about three weeks to a month ago. I'm glad that you got Larry Ramsell on the line here. Larry, my question to you is, I have fished the Chippewa Flowage a number of times. I'm wondering if you think that there's a world record muskie in there now, considering the amount of the kind of strain that's present in the lake right now. And, of course, I'm going to ask you about the spray fish, what you feel about that.
Well, I think because of the native genetics that were in the flowage when it was formed originally as part of the Chippewa River, there's always a possibility of a world-class fish being available. But since the unintentional mixing of stocks in the flowage since it was formed in 1923 by the DNR and some of the local fishing clubs, the original stock has been diluted quite a little bit, I believe. And the average size now, in fact, the high-end sizes that we see are not anything approaching what they used to be.
Yeah.
I am.
And how about the spray fish?
Give us a little background first on this. Cal Johnson and Louis Spray were a couple of the real characters associated with musky fishing here in Wisconsin, and maybe you can talk about both those guys.
Okay, let me preface it by saying that in my book, what I thought would probably be the best thing to do would be to leave history alone as it was recorded at the time. Having said that, I don't believe that Louis' fish were legitimate. I think probably what happened, it was started off somewhat innocently enough. In the late 30s, we're coming out of the Depression, the war is starting, and tourism is very low, and of course Louis was ever the promoter. So he figured out a way to generate some business in his tavern in Hayward. And his first claimed record in 39 was beat before the year was out. And that didn't satisfy Louis, so in 1940 he came up with a second world record. And had both fish mounted. And then things were quiet for a while until 1947 when a fish was caught from Lac de Flambeau that beat that fish. But Louis' 1940 fish was also beaten before it was caught, so it really never was a certified world record. And then 1949, Cal Johnson, who was a highly respected outdoor writer, came up with a 67.5-pound fish out of Coot Array that was claimed to be a new world record, but Louis wasn't having any of that either, and he sent a telegram that don't give the award yet, I'll have it beaten before the year was out. And 3 months later, he came up with his third claim for a world record, what is recognized currently as the state record and the record by the National Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame. But the investigation that's been done over the years, and particularly recently by the World Record Muskie Alliance and submitted to the Hall of Fame in 2005, and their decision in 2006 to uphold Louis' record despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary and in direct conflict with the criteria that they used to set aside the Art Lawton 1957 world record of 69 pounds, 15 ounces, left a sour taste in my mouth. I resigned as Hall World Record Advisor after 35 years of service. In fact, I began and developed the World Record Program for the Hall of Fame back in the early 70s, and it was quite a disappointment to see them use different criteria for the local boy rather than the same criteria that had been used to set aside previous record. But to get back to Louis and Cal, the professional photogrammetry work that was done indicates that the fish were not nearly as long as claimed. It also indicates that the mounts were augmented and altered to make them appear to be the size that were claimed for the fish. There's currently, it didn't get done before I went to press with my book, but there's also professional photogrammetry work being completed right now on the Cal Johnson fish that early indications are showing that it is also greatly enhanced from what it was claimed to be.
So,
real quick, the state of New York still recognizes the Lawton fish as a state record, 69 pounds, 15 ounces.
That's correct.
So, yeah. Thank you, Larry.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks a lot for calling, Dave. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or in the Madison area at 263-1890, 263-1890. 1-800-259-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments.
Larry, this is Gary. Where does Lenny Hartman's fish and his relevations before he died fit in here?
Well, I have to give Len a lot of credit. He came clean, admitted that the 60-pound fish that he and his wife claimed over the years were actually not that big, and they had been weight added to them by putting wet sand in the fish before they gathered up their witnesses for the weighing. So based on his own admission, those fish have disappeared from the record list.
Why is there such a... Why is there so much concern and so much arguing and over a couple of fish?
Well, a lot of it's jealousy. I think that goes way back in history. In fact, it's kind of ironic. I'm working on a new book right now of Muskellunge postcards. I've got over close to 600 Muskie postcards, and I'm doing a book on those. And I found a postcard that was postmarked in 1907. That said the fish was 37 pounds, and then I find the same picture in a 1911 postcard that said the fish is 42 pounds. So it started 100 years ago.
They grow over time.
Yeah.
Yeah, they that's probably true of a lot of fishermen, actually. You catch a fish, and it tends to get heavier.
Well, you always want to believe it's bigger than it is, and you take measurements, and then you guess how big it was if you let the fish go, which is done mostly today. But back in the old days, it seemed to be got to beat the next guy, so we'll put a little weight in it before we hang it on the scale and that kind of thing, or add a little water to it. There was a dozen different ways they added weight to fish, but it just always more, 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 bigger, bigger, bigger seems to be the trend. And, of course, the jealousy is the other side of the coin. Well, your fish wasn't that big, you liar, you, and that kind of thing. So it's still ongoing.
Well, it's never ending because, Larry, I do a lot of walleye fishing and walleye tournaments, and, I mean, the jealousy factor is unbelievable. And what you're finding out, I mean, the cheating in any type of event right now. I know that the new Wisconsin Muskie Tour, they had one of the winners at a tournament refuse to take a lie detector test, and they were, finished first in a tournament. I think they were, disqualified. No matter where you go, it seems like someone has to, always resort to something illegal to try and get a record fish. There's so much emphasis put on size.
Size and winning. And, of course, the other side of that coin is area promotion. And that's the problem I've got with the Hall of Fame here in Hayward is they took a decision-making process that when Lawton's fish was disqualified in 1992, the report went to the World Board of Advisory Governors for their input and decision. I think, in hindsight, they were led to the decision that arrived. But then on the other side of the coin, when you get to the spray protest in 2005, the then president of the Hall of Fame Executive Board, John Detloff, who was responsible for getting Lawton disqualified in 1992, changed the rules. He brought the decision-making process in-house to a local board that is comprised of all local business people who have a vested interest in keeping the world record in Hayward. And that just stinks to high heaven, as far as I'm concerned.
Our guest today, Larry Ramsell of Hayward, Wisconsin. He is the author of the two-volume book, A Compendium of Muskie Angling History. This is the third edition. It's just out in 2007. With us as well today, Gary Engberg of Mesa Mania, Wisconsin, professional fisherman and guide. And I tell you what, if you have some questions about the book or about muskie fishing or about some of the characters in muskie fishing, will take your calls at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. In the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking muskie angling today with our two guests, Gary Engberg and Larry Ramsell. Larry is the author of, again, The Compendium of Muskie Angling History. It's published by the House of Muskie Publications and Infinity Publishing Company. And you can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And let's go to Jim in Kaukauna next. Jim, hello. Thank you for calling.
Good morning.
Morning.
I just have kind of a silly question, but I've been muskie fishing for a couple of years, and I've talked to several different muskie guides at muskie shows, and some of these guys tell me that it gets so competitive that in order to get customers, they take three sets of change of clothes for different times of the year, and if they get a big muskie, they'll take three different pictures in three different types of clothes.
Well, it used to be you would just switch hats, you know.
So I was just I just wanted to bring that point forward. Other than that, I haven't been fishing them long enough to know enough about it yet. So,
well,
I just wondered if you folks had ever heard that.
Well, there's a tremendous amount of pressure out there, especially, you know, you have a couple. You have a local Wisconsin Muskie Tour, and then you have a national-type circuit where, you know, entry fees are, you know, are probably well over $1,000. And then you got sponsors involved with boats, motors, equipment, everything like that. So there is pressure for people to come up with big fish, whether, you know, whatever tactics or however they do it, you know, is the question involved. But I don't know. There's something nice about just going out by yourself on a nice Vilas County or Sawyer County lake and just fishing.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Jim, okay. I just wanted to make that comment.
Jim, have you caught any keepers yet?
No, but I've had a few explosions on some good lures. But, you know, like I say, I didn't know enough about it to sharpen the hooks on the new lures. I guess they come dull.
Well, you got, I'll tell you, you got a lot of
fish. There is a new hook.
You got a lot of fish up there in that Green Bay area and a lot of big fish.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim.
Okay, bye.
Appreciate the call. And let's see, let's turn to Harvey and Racine next. Harvey, hi to you.
Hi. My question is, what is the largest muskie that anybody has a record of? And I don't mean caught, hook on line, but found dead in a lake or caught by the DNR or something.
Larry, what do you have some information on that?
Yes, I do. You can go back into the historical reference, which is I do in Volume 2 of my book, and there are some fish that defy imagination, but there's no verification of any of the really claimed giants from the bygone days. But in the early 50s, the Wisconsin DNR did net a fish out of Lac Couturier here in the Hayward area that they measured at 68 inches, and that is the longest muskie that I have verification on. Like I say, some of the historical references from prior to the turn of the 1900s and even the early 1900s, there are some claims for some that are bigger than that, but none of them are verifiable.
So 68 inches, that is...
Take a formula and figure that baby out.
Yeah, you need a girth measurement, and I have a picture sitting on the wall here right in front of me, and it was a thin fish in the back section, so, you know, it may or may not have been world-class, but... who cares if it's that long? But you know, it shows that the species in, you know, the right strain from the right waters with the right forage does have the capability to reach what we're shooting for today. I don't think there's a musky fisherman out there, if he would tell the truth, that isn't always hoping that the next cast is a new world record.
Yeah, well,
thank you,
Larry. Our fish now in Wisconsin are coming out of the Thompson Center and Spooner. Most of the fish.
From where?
From Spooner.
In Madison area?
No, I mean in the state of Wisconsin.
Well, the western part of the state gets their fish from Spooner. Mm-hmm. The eastern part of the state gets their fish from the Woodruff Hatchery at Woodruff, Wisconsin.
Okay, what strain do you consider the best?
Well, what you're using in Green Bay right now is the best. But of course, they didn't come from Wisconsin. They came from Michigan and the Lake Huron drainage waters. They're the Great Lake strain.
Great Lake strain.
I think the Great Lake strain, the Mississippi River strain, which is what Minnesota's using for their musky program, those are the fish that have the capability to reach the maximum sizes. Dr. Castleman's done some work based on clethrum studies, and those waters, the waters of the St. Lawrence, which is also a Great Lakes drainage, seem to have the maximum growth that it would take combined with good growth girth-wise and catch it at the right time, of course, and right now is the prime time of the year to catch a fish that'll weigh the heaviest because it's got 50-6% of its eggs already.
We just recently in the Madison area released Muskie, the Madison Inc. chapter in Madison, and the Oregon Muskie Busters and the Illinois Flatlanders contributed and stocked the Madison chain with the Leech Lake strain.
Yes, there was also 800 put in Lake Wissota over on the western side of the state near Eau Claire. from the Leech Lake strain as well. So that's the second or third time that those fisheries have received the Leech Lake spotted fish, and I think in the next 5, 6, 7 years you're going to start seeing some tremendous size fish coming from those two fisheries as well.
Well, as an example, a guide who guides with us in our association, Lee Talkin, spends 3-4 months on Mille Lacs in Minnesota. Last year, 23 fish over 50 inches. This year, 18.
Yeah, and that's common for the guides. In fact, a lot of Wisconsin guides have bailed out and moved to Minnesota,
yep,
or taken their operation to Minnesota because it's just it's incredible what's going on over there, and it all is a result of the Minnesota DNR coming to the realization in the late 80s that they were using the wrong strain of fish for stocking. They completely revamped their hatchery program, and they're doing everything right. And in fact, I just yesterday had a chance to read their new proposed 20-year plan for the future, and they've got their ducks in a row, and they're doing things right.
Plus, for guides, well, Wisconsin guide can go over there, and there's no special requirements. You can just guide, too.
Exactly.
And you're talking about Mille Lacs. Mille Lacs, I mean, you're talking about a body of water that's 100,000 acres and has a great forage base. It's got tulabies, cisco, you know, everything a good fish would want.
You got Winnebago right there, Not too far. They're starting to put the Great Lakes strain in, and if VHS doesn't cause problems and they keep stocking on a regular basis, I think you're going to see some fantastic fish come out of there in a few years as well.
You know, some listeners might say, well, now, what's all this business about strains? Can you explain this concept of the different strains, Larry?
Well, look, if you go back 10, 12,000 years, all muskies came from the Mississippi River, whether they be muskies clear out in St. Lawrence River, New York, or whether they be muskies in Minnesota or Wisconsin. But over that period of thousands of years, they became isolated in different watersheds. When glacier waters receded, some of them were landlocked in lakes that they couldn't get in or out of. And so these fish evolved a life strategy that is, you know, conducive to the waters that they're currently in. And that has evolved and evolved over many, many years. So there are some waters, like if you take a small landlocked lake, whether it be Wisconsin, Minnesota, Ontario, or New York, those fish evolved in the absence of pike, and they had no need to get big, so they don't get big. Now you take the historic situations where muskies had to compete with northern pike, you have the strains of fish that have the capability to get big because they spawn just shortly after the pike, and they have had to evolve a strategy of separation. So muskies in those situations learn to spawn deeper so they'd have some survival. Mother Nature endowed them with bigger bodies to create more eggs. In fact, a 65-pound fish that came out of Georgian Bay in 1988 had 850,000 eggs in it. Compared to a inland strain lake like is common here in Wisconsin, 250,000 eggs would be a lot.
Talking about Winnebago, though, I mean, it's the Winnebago system is a gigantic watershed, but the main lake, you know, it's 12 miles wide, 30 miles long, but your maximum depth is only 19 feet. Do you think that will make any difference?
Well, what that does is allows the water to get warmer during the summer period, which could accelerate growth and somewhat limit the upper end. But from what's going on right now with the concern over too many 50-inch fish being harvested out of there with the potential of VHS to hit that population and possibly even wipe it out. But there already have been fish up to 59 inches that I'm aware of that have come out of there. So that is reaching the upper confidence limits of the maximum growth of those fish, even in that little bit warmer water. So I don't see the limiting of those fish growing to their max potential, even though it is a shallower section of the Great Lakes.
When you take a look at the Great Lakes, I mean, those huge bodies of water, do you see the potential for some really large, very, very large muskies coming out of the Great Lakes?
Well, it's a combination of the size. They have the opportunity to escape the anglers for the most part. They've got all the forage that they could possibly utilize. The growing season seems to be in the 46th parallel. All across the North American muskie range seems to be the pretty high optimum for maximum growth. So they've got everything working for them. And the problem with the Green Bay situation is, A, it's an introduced, reintroduced reestablished fishery that is coming on strong now, but stocking would have to maintain at its current levels, and with the VHS threat, in fact, they didn't even raise muskies in the Wild Rose hatchery this year. If VHS hits that population as hard as it hit the St. Lawrence River, where it's wiped out probably 40 to 50% of the adult fish there, it could pretty much wipe out that population when combined with the harvest that's going on as well. I heard just a couple days ago that there's one taxidermist in the area up there that's got 20 over 50 inches in his freezer right now. That even as good as that fishery is right now, it cannot sustain that kind of harvest.
Have you had any reports of any big fish coming out of the Ottawa River there in Ontario? Or
oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, I've caught them myself.
Close to Montreal and Quebec, and
yeah, all the way, it goes all the way up past the capital Ottawa, and even further west back this way. There's probably 300 miles of the Ottawa River that has muskies in good numbers. The entire Ottawa system has them in its 600 mile length. You've got 500-600 miles of the St. Lawrence River, same situation. All Great Lakes strain fish. So, you know, anywhere you've got the Great Lakes connected waterways, you've got potential for giant fish.
Are those fish caught by normal casting, or are they trolling fish?
They do both.
Both.
I fish out there quite a bit myself. I've caught them up to 57 inches casting. I've caught them up to 56 inches trolling. So it's just, you know, you apply the technique that's applicable at the, for the situation that you're in at the time.
Do you have any opinion on trolling?
I used to hate trolling. Of course, I grew up fishing Wisconsin in non-trolling waters, so I was a caster. I loved to cast, but once I learned how to troll properly, I became a real fan.
The only thing I think, like, some of the fish out there, like the Detroit River and Lake St. Clair, some of the fishing there, like Captain Larry Jones and some of them, you know, how they torpedo, you know, muskies out the back of the boat when they release them. I was just wondering on how good the success ratio of survival is there.
I don't think Larry Jones does that on the Niagara River, but there's definitely a bad deal going on in Lake St. Clair. In fact, I've got a video that was made there, and they actually shows them netting a fish, flopping in the bottom of the boat, and then another reel goes off, so they leave the fish flopping in the bottom of the boat while they take a second net, net the second fish, unhook it first, plunge it into the water, then finally get back to the first fish, unhook it, plunge it in the water. One of them floats up, and they say, well, it'll be okay, but we'll come back later and check on it. That's baloney.
Yeah.
When the first year of the Professional Muskie Tournament Trail had their tournament on Lake St. Clair, one of the big complaints from the tournament contestants who were not from that area were that they were having to take some of their time to stop and revive fish that weren't dead, that somebody had plunged and left, you know, to
floating.
Die, had they not stopped and revived the fish mm-hmm. properly. So but, you know, Lake St. Clair has probably got more muskies per acre than any musky, you know, water that's of that caliber
is.
In the world.
Yeah.
And they're spoiled over there.
Larry Ramsell of Hayward, Wisconsin, author of A Compendium of Musky Angling History, with us today. Gary Engberg of Mazamani, Wisconsin, professional fisherman and guide, comes by every so often to be on the program talking with us about muskie fishing and muskies and Larry's book. And certainly you can tell from their conversation, these guys know a lot about muskies and muskie fishing and are willing to share their opinions. They've got good, strong opinions. You may have a question about fishing or about the books or about the records. If you do, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Larry, in your books, do you have a favorite character or favorite story or two before we go back to the phones?
Well, I love the real old stuff from the old days. You know, it's just interesting to see the way they wrote in those days. It's much more prose type of writing. And they can take a modest-sized fish and make a fantastic story out of it. That was one thing that I enjoyed being able to do in this third edition when it took on a life of its own and I seen how big they were going to get. I thought, I might as well put in everything I got. So I was able to put in all the catch stories that I had of the world-class fish and some not nearly that big from the old days, and it's just fun and great reading. I just love that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Larry, you probably know a guy who was a great friend of mine, and matter of fact, who taught me many things that I know about fishing, was Porter and Pop Dean from the Boulder Junction area.
Yes, excellent muskie fishermen. Yeah.
Porter was something else.
Kathy and De Pere, we're going to give you a chance next. Kathy, hello to you.
Good morning. I have a little muskie story. I have a picture of my husband, who's now 57, and he's standing next to the back door with his fishing pole and this huge muskie. And he bragged about that picture, and we framed it, and it's in our home. Well, I always asked him what happened. Did they get the fish mounted or what? He couldn't remember. So after his parents died, we cleaned out his dad's garage. And I said, honey, get over here. I found the muskie. And he's like, no kidding. And I'm like, so we pulled this thing out, this big fish, and here it wasn't. It was a great big plaster fish. And it looked so real, but it was, you know, it had 50 years of dust on it. So I took it out. And he thought it was real, you know, when he was a kid. He was so proud of it. Well, we took it out, and I kind of cleaned it up and touched it up with some paint and varnished it, and it looks real. And we have it at the hunting cabin, and everyone thinks that's the fish that my husband caught that's in that picture.
So probably got some good weight, too.
But when you mentioned the fish loaded with sand, that's the first thing I thought is, wow, this fish is so much heavier than I thought a dead fish could be.
Well, you know, it very well could be that was a mounted fish, because they did, in some of the old mountings, did use plaster or something of that nature, which made them extremely heavy.
Well, maybe it is. It was totally covered with plaster.
Yeah, it could have been that the original skin had rotted away over the years, and all that was left was the plaster. But it very likely was the mount of that fish originally.
Well, we preserved it, and it's hanging up, and it's the talk of the town.
Good for you, Kathy.
It's more fun if it is a plaster fish.
Thanks for calling. Mark in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I can remember Trigg's Grocery Store in Eagle River used to have a huge muskie mounted, and it had been caught by a DNR survey crew, I think, when they were surveying the lake doing fish counts. And I don't remember the weight of that thing, but it seemed to me that it must have been around 90 pounds, but it, of course, wasn't caught with a rod and reel, but it was apparently died or perished when they were doing this survey. Do you guys remember anything about that?
Larry, do you remember?
No, I haven't heard anything about that one. The name Trigg's does ring a bell. It seems to me somebody has brought some information to me with that name involved in it. But there was a reported 102-pounder netted by the DNR from Minocqua in 1902, but that turns out to have been embellished somewhat by too much imbibement before telling the story.
They added an extra digit, I think.
Did you know Trigg's grocery store, Gary?
Yeah, I go to the one in Minocqua and Woodruff there.
Was this the actual mount, Gary, or was it a picture?
This was I didn't see the actual the one in Eagle River the guy was talking about.
Oh, but you just knew the story.
Yeah, I've heard the story, but I heard it was like 80 some pounds, so it grew a little.
Yeah. Well, there have been a few fiberglass replicas made long before the current fiberglass replicas became popular that were embellished beyond all belief, 100-pound class type things, and I cover a couple of those in my book as well. But there has never been, and I've made this clear since my first edition clear back in 1982, there's never been, to my knowledge, a muskie hung on a scale that exceeds anything known to have been caught by angling.
Okay. Dick in Marion, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Dick.
Hi. I have questions regarding VHS, three of them. Number one, does it affect different species of fish differently, especially families like the trout family, the pike and the muskie family, or the panfish families and so forth? The second part of my question is, is VHS throughout the United States, for example, does it appear in the southern part of the states or not? And is it only in the northern part? And then my third question is VHS in other parts of the world, let's say in Europe and
okay.
You know, the Asian Rim and so forth.
Well, I can say a few things. I know that VHS popped up. I know it's been in Japan and Australia, and mostly those were in, I think, some captive fish farms and trout farms. And as far as the research I've done, it seems to affect most species of fish overall. I don't think it particularly, you know, picks on one species. Larry, what do you know?
It's been in the trout and salmon in the West Coast. It started in its current rampage, I guess you'd call it, about 2004, 2005 on the St. Lawrence River. This seems to be a different strain of VHS than was known originally. It went from there. It hit the population real hard in Lake St. Clair a couple years ago. It's now been found in Lake Michigan, and I'm
Lake Huron.
Yeah, I'm afraid it's just a matter of time before it hits the Lake Michigan reintroduction population.
And one thing I think there should be said, too, is that a lot of people don't realize, though, when you get off a body of water right now, you can't, you know, you shouldn't be leaving that body of water with live fish still in your live well or live bait. You have to get rid of that as soon as you get off a body of water to prevent that transmission. And I don't know if people realize all the regulations there.
Even the weeds on the trailer need to be removed.
You got it. Clean off everything.
Yep.
Joe and Hayward, your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. Say, we used to go to a resort years ago in Hayward called Shear's Ghost Lake Lodge.
Mm-hmm.
And old Fred Shear, at the time, Field and Stream and all those magazines used to come up there to fish, and they called him the Muskie King. And when he died, the Chicago Trib sports page was black-bordered, in respect to him, and it had all of his fishing stories and everything. Is he part of your book?
Fred himself is not, for many reasons, and I won't elaborate, but he is quite well known, was one of the real pioneers of the resorting industry here in the Hayward area. His sons carried on after his demise. The resort that they started was Boulder Lodge. In fact, I just was looking at one of the postcards today that said Shear Brothers Proprietors. That was a very popular resort, and then they started a new resort called Shear's Ghost Lake Lodge in another location on Ghost Lake, and that's the lodge that the outdoor writers came to in the real heavily in the 50s. There's a lot of magazine articles that I've got that were written by different outdoor writers that came to Shear's and caught muskies.
Hmm. Larry, are you frozen up there yet?
Yes.
You are now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I tell you what, it's been a pleasure to talk with both of you today. Larry, how do people get a copy of your book?
You can either call me at 715-462-9880 if you don't have access to the Internet, or you can go on the Internet to my website at www.larryramsell.com. On the upper left-hand corner, there's a link to click on, and at the bottom of the page that comes up is an order form link as well.
So larryramsell.com?
Correct.
And it's R-A-M-S-E-L-L.
That'll get it.
All right. And to you, Gary, you've got a website as well.
Yeah, I got a good website, and the new one will be launched, I think, the 17th of December, www.GaryEngbergOutdoors.com or G. Engberg, it's ENGBERG.com. We got a live blog, fishing reports, links. It's great.
Thank you both for being with us today. Really appreciate it. Larry, thanks. Gary, thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Larry.
Musky Fishing, and the book, again, is titled A Compendium of Musky Angling History, Volumes 1 and 2, over 1,200 pages there of information and stories about musky angling in Wisconsin and a little bit about elsewhere as well. Coming up, we're going to be talking about appreciating our state's vibrant and innovative rural businesses, organizations, and communities. There's a book out that celebrates that, and we'll be talking with our two guests coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.